Okay, good morning, everyone. It's a special schus that we have this morning to be joined and to be addressed by Rabbi Yonah Riis Shlita. Rabbi Riis is somebody personally who has been a Rebbe to me and a mentor and a shutuf and a yoetz, and is somebody who the worldwide Jewish community, certainly the community in America, has been very fortunate to be able to call upon for leadership in many different areas of life. And is somebody who has served in many different capacities, has served as the Dean of REITs and as the head of the Beis Din of America, and now the head of the Beis Din of the CRC in Chicago, and has a tremendous amount of experience and knowledge in many areas, and certainly the area that we've been talking about, Hilchos Geiros, and today to discuss its practical components. Among his many other accomplishments, Beris is also the author of a Chashuva Sefer, the Kanfayona, which has many important discussions about Geiros as well that we've quoted going back to day one. And it's a tremendous schus to be able to have him with us today to address the practical considerations that connect to the sugyas we've been talking about these past few weeks. Without further ado, Rabbi Riis.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Shulman. I really appreciate that very warm introduction, and it's a personal privilege to have a strong friendship with Rabbi Feldman. We work together on the REITs Press and other projects, resolution of Aguna issues, together with the Oro organization. Rabbi Feldman is a true Talmid Chacham par excellence and a delightful Baal Midos, a wonderful person to work with always. So you've been learning a lot from Rabbi Feldman about Hilchos Geiros, and Rabbi Feldman asked me to speak a little bit about some of the practical situations in Geiros. Difficult to figure out exactly what to cover and how much to cover over a single shiur of 45 minutes to 1 hour, but I want to touch upon some of the highlights, and of course I welcome questions as well. Just as a little bit of a backdrop, Gemara in Krisis, as you know, speaks about how Kachem Kager teaches us that the Geiros experience is supposed to mimic, on some level, the experience of Kabbalah's HaTorah at Har Sinai, when the entirety of the nation of Klal Yisrael became a Geirim on some level. And the Gemara there derives from various psukim that we learn that every single Geir has to undergo Mila and Tefillah, because this is what our forefathers did at Har Sinai. There are two other really essential components to the Geiros process. One is Kabbalos Ol Mitzvos, which many understand as either the Mahusa Geiros, the centerpiece of the essence of the Geiros process, of Amar, Shlomo Amar, former Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel, now the Sephardic chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, likes to say that the word the Hiskayir itself means to accept the totality of mitzvos. That's the essence of the Geiros experience. So where do we find that? At Har Sinai, the Gemara doesn't talk about it, but Rav Soloveitchik says that it's very obvious. That's the moment in which the entire nation declared Naseh V'Nishma. Just as that was an integral part of the Har Sinai experience, so too it's an integral part of every single Geiros experience, whether it's the essence or a prerequisite, as Rav Tzal Zsolti in his essay in the Torah Sheba'al Peh journal suggests. Certainly that's indispensable. And then the fourth essential component of the Geiros procedure is that it has to be in front of a Beis Din. It has to be in front of a Kosher Beis Din. Question whether you need Dayanim Smuchin. That's what Tosfos asked. How can you have Geiros Bizman Hazeh when we don't have Dayanim Smuchin, going back to Moshe Rabbeinu? So this is an application of Shlichus Sayu de Kamaika of Dinan, that we are the agents of the original Dayanim. But the Rambam seems to say you can have three dayanim who are not necessarily smukin, can have anoshim kesherim. You just need people who are not possible to be a dayan in terms of their conduct. They haven't committed veros that would label them to be rishayim. But Moshe writes, you need at least one person who is well-versed in Hilchos Geirus, who can give instruction to the other two individuals, L'chatchila, where Machmir to require a Beis Din that's made up at least of Rabbanim who have contemporary smicha, even if it's only imitation smicha, there should be some sense of the Shlichusayu component that's discussed by Tosos, that's discussed by a number of other poskim, of Cook in the Das Kohen, also speaks about the Shlichusayu component. The Nesivos at the beginning of Choshen Mishpat speaks about the Shlichusayu component of the Dayonim who serve on a Beis Din, the Gior. This is also indispensable. You have a Ger who's Mal V'Tovo B'fnei Atzmo, not in front of a Beis Din. Ain't no Ger. It's not considered to be a Ger. So where do we find the Beis Din in the Har Sinai experience? So here you have two different approaches. You have one approach which you'll find in Rav Soloveitchik and other places as well, who say that the Beis Din takes the place of the Shechina, that at Har Sinai, you have B'nai Yisrael receiving the Torah, and you had the Shechina that was present at Har Sinai, as we read this morning in the Shir Shoyom, Elokim Nitzav Badas Kel B'Kerav Elokim Yishpot, that the Beis Din is the stand-in for the Shechina, and that's why you need to have the Beis Din as part of this covenantal commitment of the Ger, just like the Shechina was present in full force at Har Sinai. The other explanation that's suggested by Rav Shaul Yisraeli, Rav Zsolti, I believe, as well, gives this explanation. Rav Shechter likes to attribute this approach to the Beis Halevi on Parshas Lech Lecha as well, is that at Har Sinai you had the totality of Klal Yisrael. It was Klal Yisrael entering together into the Bris, and therefore you need some representation of the totality of Klal Yisrael in any point in time in which another person is going to be brought into the covenant of our nation. And the Beis Din is the stand-in for the entirety of Klal Yisrael, that they serve the function of ensuring that there be a proper process in terms of what it takes to enter into the Bris of Klal Yisrael in terms of our acceptance of the Torah, our being an Am Segula in our relationship towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So it could be that these two different understandings of the role of the Beis Din, of whether the Beis Din represents the Shechina, whether the Beis Din represents Klal Yisrael, these are the dual aspects of the Geirus experience that are discussed by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zichrono Livracha, in his essay in Tradition. He wrote an essay about Geirus. He wrote a number of very beautiful essays and gave a number of beautiful shiurim that I heard over the years on the laws of Geirus. So Rav Aaron wrote an article in 1988 in Tradition in which he points out that there are really two different parts of the Geirus experience. One is sort of the existential connection of the Geir with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that it's an intimate relationship for somebody who discovers HaKadosh Baruch Hu, like Avraham Avinu, discovering monotheism and embracing a special relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And then there's the second part of the Geirus experience, which is the Geirus process itself, going through the nuts and the bolts of the Geirus process of Mila and Tevila Kabbalos O Mitzvos and so forth, that you check off the boxes and you make sure that you have satisfied all of the prerequisites in order to have completed all of the procedural requirements of the Geirus experience. So it could be that maybe this corresponds to these two different approaches. On the one hand, when one appears before the Beis Din, they're appearing before Shechina, and they're solidifying their special intimate relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore the Beis Din is a representative of the Shechina in that sense. On the other hand, the Beis Din also has a responsibility of Kabbalas Hager, that the Beis Din has to see to it that all of the procedural requirements are properly followed, that there is a proper investigation of the Ger's motivations, that there's a proper Kabbalos Mitzvos, that there's a proper Mila, that there's a proper Tevila, that there is the necessary process of conversion which takes place. And every single Geirus that is overseen by Beis Din really has this duality to it, that you're creating, you know, a new individual. That's why we say Geir, Shinis Geir, Kekoton, Shinola Domi. You're creating a special new relationship between an individual and a Kodesh Baruch Hu, but you're also ensuring that the responsible steps are in place in order to bring somebody new into Klal Yisrael. So for a long time here in America, there was sort of a free-for-all, Wild West approach towards the Geirus, that different rabbis in different communities would just do their own thing with wildly varying standards in terms of the measure of Kabbalah Sol Mitzvos that was necessary, in terms of even the knowledge base of different Rabbanim regarding Hilchos Geirus. Some were not so knowledgeable, and some made very elementary mistakes that really would invalidate Geirus. There was one Rav who didn't do conversions that often, but he didn't know too many other Orthodox rabbis in his region. So whenever he needed to do a Geirus, he would call over his brother, who was a rabbi nearby, to sit on the Beis Din. But of course, you can't have two Krovim sitting on a Beis Din. That automatically creates a Beis Din Pasul, an invalid Beis Din, and then you have an invalid Geirus. So people didn't necessarily know the halachos at all. And there was also a sense of, unfortunately, a certain amount of corruption. People who would just say, we'll do a quickie conversion if you pay $15,000 or something like that, and take you in front of an Orthodox Beis Din and put you in a mikveh. Obviously, that's not a very Orthodox Torah-based way to perform a conversion, but unfortunately, you had a little bit of corruption as well. And as a result, whenever a conversion would be performed, because there was such a discrepancy between different standards and different levels of integrity amongst different Batei Din, it was often very difficult to be able to tell whether a particular Geirus was valid or not valid. So for a period of time, the Rabbinical Council of America put together an Ishur system, a system where they didn't perform conversions directly through any kind of a centralized Beis Din. It happens, Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Shlita, told me that the reason why the Beis Din of America, for example, did not perform conversions directly was because it was often such a sordid business. As I mentioned, Rabbanim would get a lot of pressure sometimes to convert people who were dating children of Balabatim in their shuls, who were wealthy Balabatim, and there was pressure put on to perform conversions where maybe there wasn't the requisite commitment to perform mitzvos and so forth. So the Rav felt that it was better to stay away from the whole conversion scene. But as a result, the conversion scene became a very sullied and a very problematic one in general. So as any time the conversion, and they tried to identify Rabbanim whom they felt were more careful than others when it came to performing conversions. And they felt that at least if these Rabbanim would perform conversions, they would be able to validate them, that they felt that they could be trusted. But it still wasn't under any kind of centralized Beis Din supervision. And then sometimes even with those Rabbanim, you would have question marks regarding certain conversions. Was there a proper Kabbalah Sol Mitzvos or not? So at a certain point in time, the Beis Din of America, through Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, started to develop what's known as an Ishur system, that if there was a conversion that was performed and there was a desire to memorialize the fact that this was recognized as one of the valid conversions as opposed to one of the questionable conversions, so a request would be registered for Rabbi Schwartz to certify the conversion, to authenticate it, to provide an Ishur on the conversion. And he would sit down at that point in time. The chairman of the Geirus Commission of the Rabbinical Council of America was Rabbi Shlomo Ribek Shlita, and Rabbi Schwartz and Rabbi Ribek would sit down every single month. Rabbi Ribek would present to Rabbi Schwartz all the cases that had been submitted for Ishur for certification, and would have done his research, as to who the Rabbanim were who sat on the Besdin, whether they could be trusted, who had followed proper standards, and what were the circumstances of each individual case, was there a proper Kabbalah Sol Mitzvos, etc., etc. And Rabbi Schwartz would either give an Ishur, he would either give a certification, or he wouldn't give a certification. So this system certainly was better than having no oversight altogether. But at a certain point in time, the rabbis in other locations who were relying upon conversions from America, particularly the Rabbanut in Eretz Yisrael, said they didn't like the system so much. Why didn't they like the system? Because number one, they like to have Batei Din that were recognized, Batei Din that were performing the conversions, as opposed to individual rabbis who were just picking out, you know, other Rabbanim in their area or learning Balabatim, Mismicha in their shul and so forth to sit on the Besdin. They felt that it should be something that is more rigorous, something which is more streamlined, something which is more centralized. Number two, they felt that if you didn't have the Batei Din that were trusted institutional Batei Din in their own right, then if you weren't directly involved in the process, even if you yourself were reliable and trustworthy, how can you really give a perfect certification to the Giyur? And number three, it put Rabbi Schwartz in a very uncomfortable position because there were people who would turn to him for Shilos, who respected him, who liked him, who would perform Giyur, and Rabbi Schwartz would say, I'm sorry, but I can't authenticate your Giyur. I'm not comfortable with your standards. I'm not come. Sometimes there would be a rabbi who had a synagogue without a mechitza, who had orthodox smicha, but in such a synagogue, how could there be a proper Kabbalah Sol Mitzvos? And never mind, you know, the question of the credentials of a dayan who would be a rabbi in such a synagogue. And Rabbi Schwartz would say, I can't certify a geirus which was performed by a rabbi who serves in such a synagogue, and it led to a lot of ill feelings as well. So it was not a perfect system on many, many levels. So what happened was that approximately 13, 14 years ago, the RCA decided to develop a more streamlined system in which it would identify particular Batei Din that were recognized Batei Din for purposes of conversion. This would include established Batei Din like the RCC in California, Rabbinical Council of California, our own Chicago Rabbinical Council. You could see, you know, the background of the CRC Besdin behind me that were recognized institutional Batei Din to perform conversions. And there would be a list of recognized Dayanim. Even that list would be reviewed by the Rabbanut in Eretz Yisrael that they would make sure they had a comfort level with those Dayanim. We published a list of procedures and guidelines that would have to be followed in terms of the standards for Kabbalah Sol Mitzvos, the standards for guiding a ger through a gerus process. So what are the standards? Even you do a ger katon, you convert the minor. What's the level of commitment in terms of shmiras and mitzvos of the parents, adoptive parents, in order to convert a minor? Things of that sort, everything very, very rigorously decided. And there was a committee that was drawn up of Chashuv Rabbanim even to articulate these different standards. And thus was hatched the GPS system of established Batei Din. Now there are, I believe, 12 official GPS of Batei Din throughout North America that oversee conversions where you have these streamlined standards. And one of the perhaps the most important advantages of the creation of the GPS was that the major rabbinic bodies in the world, whether you're talking about the chief rabbinate in Israel or the London Besdin or the Paris Besdin or even Rabbanim in various other cities in North America that wouldn't necessarily know whether to trust a particular giyur or not to trust a particular giyur, would have a greater level of comfort that if a conversion was performed under this GPS system, which was a more centralized system for Giyur, that they could know that the Ger is considered to be a valid convert and they wouldn't have to conduct a de novo investigation on their own as to whether they're comfortable with the Giyur or not, something which was the cause of an untold amount of agony and agmas nefesh for so many gerim to have to have their gerus and their status scrutinized after the fact, and sometimes it would be 20 years after the fact when it would be a child of the ger who would want to make aliyah when the mother had converted 20 years earlier, and there would be a question as to whether this child is going to be viewed as Jewish or not, and sometimes the child would have to go through the indignity of a gir, the chumrah, even though their mother's gerus was strictly speaking a kosher gerus, but there wasn't enough evidence, enough of a system in place where anybody could know that for sure. So now you avoided all of those pitfalls, and you know, Baruch Hashem, I would say that the creation of the GPS has been a tikkun gadol in terms of number one, improving and streamlining the standards for the performance of a gerus, and number two, ensuring that when you do have a ger tzedek, when you do have a proper convert who goes through a proper conversion procedure, that this convert's conversion will be accepted and will be respected without any questions all over the world. But you know, one of the criticisms that was leveled against the GPS almost from its very inception by some of the rabbis who were used to opening up their own local shop for conversion in their own shuls and their own communities was that it took away from the special relationship between, say, the shul rav and a convert, when the shul rav is orchestrating every single step of the conversion and performing the conversion himself. So you have more of that sense of that special spiritual experience that perhaps comprises the first element of the conversion experience, that sense of connection with the divine, the connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and now it became a more bureaucratic process. So the advantage of it being a more bureaucratic process is the secondary aspect of the conversion experience, the representation of Klal Yisrael to make sure that the standards of entering into Klal Yisrael, that the procedural rules are properly followed. That's why the GPS, people wonder, what does it stand for? When the GPS was created, it's before we had the GPS navigation system to get you from point A to point B. This was our spiritual GPS. Really, I don't know, maybe we should have sued for copyright infringement or something when the other GPS came along. But our GPS stood for Gerus policies and standards, that it was simply a procedural guide as to how Gerus should be conducted properly. So this way, because of the fact that you had Dayonim who were more removed and more objective, you didn't have to worry about the pressures that were placed on certain Rabbanim of shuls to perform gear when it wasn't really warranted up yolacha. You didn't have to worry as much about the integrity of the process because there were certain rules that have to be followed. And of course, rules that have to be followed, you also have to make sure that you have a certain amount of oversight so that when the rules are violated, Dayanim, you know, can be removed and disciplined as appropriate. And as I'll discuss in just a few moments, we did have a real very serious and severe test case in that regard. But at least there were rules in place in order to ensure the integrity of the process. And number three, you have more of a general acceptance of all of the conversions which are performed precisely because there is such a recognized, centralized, streamlined system in place. But at the same time, the complaints that were registered certainly resonate to some degree. What about the first component of the Gerus experience, that special intimate connection with the divine? When it becomes more bureaucratic, it's harder to feel that. And this is something that we've tried to be very sensitive to over the years as well, that even though it perhaps is a little bit more removed and ultimately that creates more advantages than disadvantages to have objective dayanim who are involved in the process, but there's still an important element of the way in which GPS conversions are conducted. There still does need to be a sponsoring rabbi, a rabbi of the shul or community who does develop a special relationship with the gerus candidate. It's not a relationship that will ultimately affect the decision of whether or not to perform the gear, because the sponsoring rabbi will not be part of that decision, but the sponsoring rabbi can help to mentor and monitor the candidate as the candidate goes along. You know, the other thing that you potentially forfeit, I see a hand up, I'll call on your motion in just a moment, that there's also sometimes the feeling that there are special situations that require a certain amount of flexibility, that sometimes you have rigorous rules in place, and maybe the rules don't have to be identical. Let's say that if the rule is that a Gayrus candidate needs to go through at least a year or two of a fully observant Jewish life while part of the Gayrus process, and you have a Gayrus candidate who comes along who, even though they weren't formally a candidate, they were living a very frum life for a long time because they mistakenly thought they were halakhically Jewish, and it turns out they weren't halakhically Jewish. They thought the mother had a valid conversion. It wasn't a valid conversion. So you also make sure, you also require, because after all, the rules are the rules, that this person also has to go through a full year, a full 2 years, even when the person's basically been observant their entire life. So you have to have a certain amount, not to compromise the principles of halakha chas v'shalom, but just to address the realities of different situations, you have to have a certain amount of flexibility built in. So that's something which we've always tried very hard to fine tune. If you look at the official GPS document, which is listed, I think, on the RCA website, and it's a Gayrus page, you see there are a number of places where it's built in that there might be a certain cases where flexibility is called for when it comes to a particular rule, a particular standard. Then it says that in such a case, you'll consult with a local Bezdin. Local Bezdin will consult with the national GPS office. We also have a GPS committee that I serve as the chairman right now of the GPS committee. And that these types of special situations can be evaluated. Like, for example, we have a special subcommittee for those cases where there's a candidate who lives in one city but has a preference, or the sponsoring rabbi has a special preference that the conversion not go through the local Bezdin, it go through a different recognized GPS Bezdin in a different city, then the candidate will travel to that other city and so forth because there are certain sensitivities where they live. So nothing in that regard, when it's administrative in nature and not halakhic in nature, is etched in stone. And the system does allow for a certain amount of flexibility because it's very important that every single Gayrus experience incorporate both of these notions to the fullest extent possible. Number one, that's very special transformative nature of the Gayrus experience of each Gayrus special individual connection with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. And secondly, the importance of ensuring the integrity of all of the procedural steps in the Gayrus process. Yes, Moshe, please.
Hi, Rabbi. Thank you for joining us. I had a question. One was a clarification question, and one was a separate question. So when Rabbi says that a requirement is like 2 to 3 years of observant life, did that person go through the conversion yet fully, or is it that we're waiting till the end to do the tefillah? Because if he already did milan tefillah, in that 2 to 3 years, while we're still determining if he's going to lead a full life, is he a full Jew? Can he get aliyahs in the shul? Can he marry a Jew in that time? Like what?
So it's a very good question. Really what we're talking about is the level of commitment and knowledge and integration that's necessary before we even do the Gayrus to begin with. Once we do the Gayrus, so then the Gayrus is over, meaning that the Bezdin should only do the Gayrus when they're comfortable, that they are ready to accept this person as part of Klal Yisrael. So Rambam writes that once the person, based on the Gemara, once the person becomes part of Klal Yisrael, if they go off the derech, if they don't end up being observant years later, so they're like any Yisrael Mumar, Shekidushev Kidushin, they become like anybody who was born Jewish who didn't end up remaining observant, who is still considered to be a member of the Jewish nation, is still responsible for all of their actions. If they contract, if it's a man, he contracts a marriage with a Jewish woman, it's considered to be a valid marriage, and a get is required. So the main point of the Bezdin's involvement is prior to the actual Maisa Tfila, to the immersion in the mikvah in the presence of the Bezdin, which is the culmination and finalization of the Gayrus process. That's the whole debate in the incidents of with Hillel and Shammai and the Gemara and Shabbos, when there were these converts who didn't seem to be 100% ready or 100% sincere, and Shammai chased them away with a brick, with a heavy brick, and Hillel worked with them. And one of the questions that the Mephoshim ask is, when Hillel worked with them, does that mean that he first put them in the mikveh, and then after he had them immersed in the mikveh and become Jewish, so then he taught them all of the things that they were deficient about? The person only wanted to keep Torah shebichtav and not Torah shebaal peh, that they brought the person up to speed only after the conversion. Or was it that, no, Hillel took them in terms of working with them towards conversion, and it was only after they had a full appreciation and understanding of what it means to be a Torah Jew, hashkafically and halakhically, that he performed the conversion? The general approach of Bat Dei Din Bizman Hazeh is to assume like the second approach. Whether that's the approach followed by Hillel or not is a debate, but even if it wasn't, that's the approach that we follow, and we generally would be inclined towards the interpretation that's the approach that Hillel followed as well. And Tosfos talks about, well, with Hillel was sofen batuach haya shesofen lasos l'shem shemayim, was confident that in the end they would do the shem shemayim. That, I mean, he was confident, therefore he took them on as a candidate, or confident, and therefore he immersed them. So we assume like the first approach, confident he took them in as a candidate, like the Maharsha says, that he taught them a Torah, not because he first put them in a mikvah, but because they needed to learn a lot of Torah in order to have a better understanding of what Yiddishkeit was all about. And that was the teaching of Torah towards the process of conversion, not after the process of conversion. And even though normally we don't teach Torah to non-Jews, explains the Maharsha, this is an exception to the rule. If you have somebody who's in the Talich HaGiyur, they're in the process of Geirus, so then it's appropriate to teach them Torah for purposes of being a successful ger, like the Minchas Olazer says. You're not going to teach Hebrew, you're not going to teach the basics, so then when you perform the conversion, the ger is not going to know how to make brachos properly. You're not setting them up for success. The dictates of Lifnei Iver require that you not bring somebody into the Jewish nation in a way that they're not going to be successful at keeping the mitzvos, and they'll be subject to punishment for all kinds of mistakes because they weren't taught properly. So therefore, this is part of the responsibility of the Beis Din to teach the Geirim candidates properly so that they'll be successful at the time that they convert. We did have a major problem because the GPS in part worked with a certain existing Bat Dei Din. There was an existing Beis Din in the Washington, D.C. area, where unfortunately one of the rabbis became subject to major scandal. This was a scandal that was discovered a number of years ago with cameras in the mikveh. You're probably familiar with it. And the rabbi had to immediately be disbarred, so to speak, from his role as a rabbi. He was expelled from the synagogue where he served as the rabbi. He eventually ended up sitting in prison for a number of years. One of the questions that arose was, since you need to have kosher dayanim sitting in the Beis Din, and for a period of time, there were these cameras that apparently were sitting in the mikvahs where he was looking at video footage, which is a very serious avera, very serious transgression, a very serious breach of privacy. So what happens to the conversions that this rabbi had performed? And we really had to think about this issue very, very carefully. A lot of discussion with Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, with Rabbi Mordechai Willig, with other poskim regarding how to approach this issue. In the end, if you look at the sefer that Rabbi Feldman mentioned, that the Kanfei Yonah, there's a tshuva there that I wrote explaining different reasons for leniency. One was that in order to passel somebody from being a dayan or an aid for that matter, you need two aidim kasherim. We have a principle, ain't the mason is asma rosh. At the end of the day, we have a confession from a person. We have, circumstantial evidence, plus a confession from the person that is generally not viewed as sufficient in order to invalidate somebody from being an aide or being a dayan. It's sufficient to remove somebody from their position, but they wouldn't be intrinsically puzzled without two kosher witnesses coming along. unless you have what's known as an Anan Sadi. Yeah, the whole world knew it, even for the whole world to know it, the person only becomes invalid from the point in time in which the whole world knew it. So when the whole world knew it, he was no longer allowed to perform any conversions. And the secondary consideration is that the Gemara talks about when you do find that a person has committed acts that would cause them to become invalid as a witness or as a dayan, from what point in time do they become invalid? Do they become invalid l'mafreya from the time in which the acts have been performed? So two witnesses come forward today and they say, 10 years ago, this fellow committed murder. And the testimony is found to be valid testimony. And now we know that starting from 10 years ago, this person was a Rasha. So if the person was really a Rasha, according to the Torah definition, when the Rasha says, Asher hu Rasha l'mus, person commits a transgression for which they would be liable for the death penalty, or Asher ben Akos HaRasha, that they commit a transgression for which they would be Chayav Malkus, for which they would receive lashes according to Torah law. So then whenever that happens, we paskin like a baye, that a person, that the witness becomes invalid l'mafreya from the time in which the transgression was committed. However, if it's a type of transgression that would not be subject to Malkus or Misa for that matter, or was not what we call a Rasha de Hamas, that it was not where the Torah refers to somebody as a Rasha if they've committed certain monetary indiscretions, that they've cheated, they've stolen money and things of that sort where they can't be trusted to be truthful. So then if it does not fall under any of those categories, the person only becomes invalid as a witness or as a dayan on a Durabanan level, on a rabbinic level. And on a rabbinic level, we only invalidate witnesses mishas hachroza, from the moments in which their sin or their transgression has been publicized to the world. What's shas hachroza? You throw somebody out of their synagogue, that's viewed as a classic manifestation of shas hachroza. So here, the sins that were committed were terrible in nature, but from a technical perspective, they weren't sins for which a person would get malchus, for which a person would get lashes, or a person would get miso, they would get the death penalty. And therefore, the operative time frame for when the invalidation would take place, even if you had kosher witnesses, would only be mishas hachroza for when it was discovered and when it was revealed. Therefore, that was an additional consideration for leniency. Other considerations for leniency as well. A little bit of a discussion. Perhaps we should be more machmir, more stringent when it comes to dayanim than when it comes to edim. The simple reading of the Raman, Choshen Mishpat, is that it would be the same principle even with respect to dayanim. These types of transgressions, it would only be mishas hachroza from the time of the announcement. And therefore, based on all of these considerations, took into account the explanation of the Rambam, very beautifully says, why is it that we don't invalidate a person retroactively, even if there would be witnesses? He says, because if there wasn't a type of transgression that would invalidate the person according to Torah law. So the Rambam says, because of Zuchus Ha'am, because it's going to mess people up, because the people who relied on this individual's cheskas kashus, the person's presumption of being valid, of being kosher, and they signed contracts with these people as witnesses, they entered into marriages with these people as the Eidei Kiddushin, they signed Gittin with these people as the Eidei Gittin. So you're going to take away the Zuchus Ha'am. You're going to end up imposing a terrible burden on the entire tzibur, on the entire congregation, if you're going to invalidate people when it's not necessary to do so retroactively. So therefore, since it was not necessary to do so, we did not need, in this case either, to impose that burden upon the community to invalidate this person retroactively. Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef also agreed with this reasoning, saying it would be very difficult to invalidate under these circumstances, but he added as a footnote, but this person really shouldn't sit as a dayan anymore. So I think that we could all be in agreement with that, but it really does highlight one of the major responsibilities of those who are involved with the GPS, of putting together any kind of centralized system, is that whenever you do have a centralized system, you have to do your best to put systems in place to weed out those individuals who really should not be serving in this type of capacity. Whenever you have mentorships with individuals who want to transform their lives. It can also create a tremendous amount of vulnerability as well. And you have to beware the types of people who would prey upon those vulnerabilities. And you can't assume that just because somebody is becheskas kasher, somebody who has always been presumed to be an individual of high moral standards, that it's always going to be the place. You have to take allegations seriously, and you have to constantly review the conduct of the dayanim and of every single bezdin in the system to make sure that everything is operating properly. So there was a committee that was formed in order to, the truth is, this committee was in formation anyway, that was established to review the protocols that are in place in order to safeguard and to ensure the proper administration of the published rules and procedures and the standards of conduct that are supposed to be followed. And one of the results of this committee's deliberations, I had the schus of serving on that committee as well, was the appointment of a director, of a female director of conversion services, who would be a liaison, an individual who could be contacted by converts who are going through the process if they have any kind of uneasiness, if they have any kind of discomfort with the way in which they're being treated, with the way in which the process is being conducted, so it could be registered, it could be reviewed. And this, I think, has been a very helpful improvement to the system. Whenever you put a system in place, you always have to constantly review it to make sure that it is as perfect as possible. But this has really worked out very well. The other encouraging sign that I witnessed, you know, when we were going through this entire episode, was that there was a real concern at the time. What happens now is, should we just blow up the whole system? So the converts and the people, the potential converts, really answered the question for us. There were a number of people who were in the middle of the conversion process in Washington, D.C., and they contacted us and they said, please revamp and reconstitute the Bez in Washington, D.C. Okay, so this one was no good. There were violations of protocol. So now that you have a centralized system in place, so you have the wherewithal to make things better. And Baruch Hashem, we did. So Rabbi Tzvi Ram and I took a number of trips down to Washington, D.C. to work with the Rabbanim, who were members of the Bad there in Washington, in order to help them develop a totally new and improved Beis Din Legiur that would follow all of the standards properly and carefully, and kind of, you know, took them through the ropes, so to speak, to demonstrate the way to interact with the Geirus candidates, the way to go through the procedures, the way to go through the process. And now that Beis Din is really functioning wonderfully under excellent rabbinic leadership down there in Washington, D.C. It's a good example. It turned out to be a good example of one of the advantages of having a centralized system. Even when something goes wrong, if you have a good, solid, strong system in place, then you can use that as an opportunity for tikkun to make things better. But this is just the Geirus landscape. But nowadays, the Manhattan Beis Din is really one of the wonderful success stories, because you had so many rabbis with varying standards. Don't have to tell you what can go on, you know, between the five boroughs of New York City. You can have a tremendous variation in terms of conduct and standards of different rabbanim. And there was a creation under the GPS of the Beis Din, of the Manhattan Beis Din Legiur, which is now under the administrative leadership of Rabbi Ram, which does more geirus than any other Beis Din in the GPS system every single year. Really covers the five boroughs of Manhattan. The official Rosh Beis Din is Rav Herschel Schechter Shlita. And the fact that all of the Rabbanim in Manhattan were able to really work together to agree upon the creation of one centralized Beis Din Legiur with streamlined standards was, I think, one of the greatest successes that we've seen in terms of the creation of the GPS. Now, in terms of, you know, other contemporary issues, you always have, you know, the issue of what is the standard for Kabbalah Sol Mitzvos? You've, you know, obviously learned the famous Tshuva of Chaim Oster, which is one of these tshuvos that could mean different things to different people. What exactly did Rav Chaim Moser say? Dvarim shebalev einem dvarim. A person, you don't know what they don't tell you doesn't necessarily hurt the process. Doesn't sound 100% perfect. The base Yitzchak of Yitzchak Shmelkis says we do say dvarim shebalev heim dvarim when it comes to Geirus, because Geirus is all about this dimension of the Ger's relationship with the Kaddish Baruch Hu. So their innermost thoughts of whether they're going to accept mitzvahs is relevant to us. But the truth is, even Rav Chaim Moser says that if it's an umdan or the muchach, it's very clear, it's drama shebelev v'lev kol adam, that everybody knows that this Ger is not going to accept mitzvahs. So that is a problem. But then Rav Chaim Moser says, but it's only l'teyavon, that really they accept the correctness of mitzvahs, but out of a sense of desire, maybe they'll violate some mitzvahs, so maybe that won't invalidate the process. He was talking about really primarily those people who are converting for the sake of marriage. So on the one hand, he says, well, if it's only l'shem te'ovon, maybe it's okay. On the other hand, if there's an umdun of the muchach, they're not going to keep fundamentals like Shabbos and Kashrus, and later in a different shuvah, he has taras and mishpacha, so then it's not going to be good. So how do you reconcile these different statements of Rav Chaim Moser? Rav Lichtenstein once mentioned that there are three different elements of the Kabbalah so mitzvos discussion. One is the critical nature, do you need it or not? It's generally assumed, even from the Lashon and the Rambam, that yes, of course, it's indispensable to have Kabbalah so mitzvos. The other is the second and the third components of Kabbalah o mitzvos are the content. What's the degree of what mitzvos really have to be accepted by the candidate, and the degree of a commitment, and when they accept it, what's the degree to which they need to, have the embrace of the mitzvos. Those are sort of the three components. So two different ways of reading Rav Chaim Moser. One way of reading him is that there is a certain prerequisite in terms of content, that even if we're going to be lenient when it comes to commitment, to say, oh, if it's only the te'ovon, that really you believe in it, but you're just not going to do it so much, that's okay. But we're going to draw the line when it comes to certain hallmarks. When it comes to Shabbos and Kashrus and Taras and Mishpacha, so those are non-negotiable. Even if you're only violating that l'teyavon, that at least that amount of content you have to have. The second way of understanding Rav Chaim Moser is that no, it's all a question of the degree of commitment. But if you're not going to keep Shabbos, if we know that you're not going to keep Shabbos, Kashrus, and Taras Mishpacha, who are you kidding? Who are you kidding in terms of your degree of commitment? You don't have any commitment. There's no real commitment over there. You're going to say it's only the te'ovon. It's nothing. You have no commitment or embrace of the mitzvahs if you're not even going to keep those fundamentals. So how you understand Rav Chaim Moser also is going to color your approach towards your standard of Kabbalah so mitzvahs to some degree. I think that we pride ourselves in terms of the GPS of having a very, very high standard. If there's any kind of a sense that the Beis Din has that the person's not going to keep mitzvahs, it doesn't matter whether they say the proverbial chutz midavar echad explicitly, but if the Beis Din knows it's chutz midavar echad that there are certain things that the person's not going to keep, then the Beis Din is not going to perform the gear under those circumstances. There's a whole debate in Eretz Yisrael today regarding what's the standard of Kabbalah so mitzvos for the Russian Olim, where if you don't convert them, then you're going to have a tremendous confusion regarding Jewish identity within Eretz Yisrael of who's really Jewish and who's not Jewish. So maybe you can have a lower standard of Unterman. Rav Isser Unterman published an essay also in the same Torah Shebaal Peh journal that Rav Zsolti wrote his wonderful essay on Geirus, other wonderful essays on Geirus in that same journal as well, so where he wanted to argue that maybe you should be more lenient with respect to the Russians, because when you're worried about a Geir backsliding, what are you worried about? They're going to go back to Avodah Zarah. These Jews who came from Russia, there was no Avodah Zarah for them to go back to, and they're so happy to get out of Russia, you don't have to worry that they're going to go back to anything over there. They're going to stay in Eretz Yisrael. He didn't quote the Tosfos in Yuvam Mestap Mem Zayin, who says that we have less of a concern regarding Geirim in Eretz Yisrael because of Shivchad Eretz Yisrael, because Eretz Yisrael has a certain Shevach to it, given that you have a Tosfos. So I think in Eretz Yisrael, maybe you could take that into account. The Shivka Eretz Yisrael, you're surrounded by Jewishness, you're surrounded by Jewish culture, you're surrounded by Jewish holidays, you're surrounded by Jewish practices. Maybe there is an argument that you could make that at least when the person says that they understand the mitzvahs, they're prepared to accept it, even if it's not 100% perfect, I can understand maybe having a different approach in Eretz Yisrael. Maybe I'm not endorsing it per se, but I can understand the argument. Here in America, I don't think that the argument has any sway, because we're not living in a Jewish state per se. We're not living in a place where a person is automatically going to be surrounded with the Torah and mitzvos and Jewish practices, Jewish culture, Jewish holidays, and so forth and so forth. So here, I don't think that you can make the same arguments that are advanced in that regard, and you have to take a much more hardline approach in terms of Kabbalah. So mitzvos, also bearing in mind Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's statement of the Lifnei Iver responsibility that's imposed on the Bezdin, that you convert somebody who wasn't really qualified. So you're over in Lifnei Iver in one of two ways. Either that you're representing to the world this person is Jewish when they're not, or if they are Jewish and they're going to be committing averus, so then if because of you, this person is going to violate averus, when if they had remained the non-Jewish, they wouldn't have been violating the averus. So you have the double-edged sword in that respect, and you have to be very, very careful. There's an interesting twist in formulations that were issued by different Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael in particular about the sine qua non, a requirement of a Kabbalah so mitzvos, that there was one statement issued by the Stipler and Rav Shach, and then later on another statement issued by Rav Shach and Rav Elyashin or Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, in which they said that you have no business converting a candidate unless it's clear that there is an absolute Kabbalah so mitzvos. So Rav Avadya Yosef was known as a little bit more of a maker, at least in terms of recognizing conversions of people in the army, where it didn't seem that afterwards they were necessarily that observant. And they asked him to clarify his position. So Rav Avadya Yosef said, I also agree that an umdana demuchach is a problem. But he said in the other direction. He said, if the Bezdin sees this is an umdana demuchach, the person's not going to observe mitzvah, so then it's very possible that the conversion will be invalid, completely, it'll be null and void. So different formulations. It depends. Is your formulation that you can't perform the conversion unless it's an umdana demuchach, the person will keep mitzvos? Or is your formulation, like Rav Avadya Yosef, well, the conversion is going to be no good if there was an umdana demuchach that the person's not going to perform mitzvos? Do you have to prove a positive, or just make sure not to prove a negative? It will result, I think, potentially in different standards, at least on a bidyevid level. Certainly, the Bezdin's responsibility is to see to it that they prepare a person for success in terms of Kabbalah so mitzvos. Here at the CRC and in the GPS in general, we do reviews every few years of candidates to see how many are still fully observant after the fact. And at least at the CRC, our experience has been that over 90% are found to be still fully observant 3-5 years later. So, Baruch Hashem, if we didn't find it that way, so we would have to reevaluate what we did wrong, in those cases where it ends up not being the case. Obviously, you can't predict the future, but making sure that you put the ingredients in place in terms of responding rabbi, integration of the candidate into a strong Orthodox community, living within walking distance of an Orthodox shul, becoming part of that community, you put the ingredients in place in order to ensure success as much as possible. We're doing a survey this summer about those candidates who specifically had a Jew, they were converting, and they were engaged or living with a Jewish spouse, the Jewish significant other. The Jewish significant other obviously also had to step up their game and become, more observant in the process. But because the Shemisha situations that I'm sure you learned about, the different arguments why we're lenient to deal with such candidates altogether when we feel that at the end of the day, they're going to be fully committed. I call it Firos Enei Abezdin, as the Shach points out, every single case has to be evaluated very, very carefully. So we're doing a special survey of those candidates to see how observant they are a few years out, because we want to make sure that we do things successfully and properly. We feel we owe that responsibility to us, Klal Yisrael. We feel that we owe that responsibility towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We feel that we owe that responsibility towards the Gerim, to make sure that we're offering them the best possible process. Other issues that arise nowadays, There's no shortage of them. You can read the tshuva in my sefer about the woman with the dreadlocks, the African-American woman. Can you have a tefillah, in front of the Beis Din with dreadlocks? They have to be shaved off. I gave the argument based on the Mordechai, quoting the Rabia in the case of the Balkatrach, special types of what we'd call bad hair demons that in the olden days would cause people to have hair that would have to remain tangled because it would be dangerous to untangle it, and explain that it wouldn't be a chatzitza because when you have, when it's very, very tight, you have tightly wound hairs, so the hairs inside are considered base of starim, or maybe when you have more than two hairs that are together, so by definition, it's not considered to be tight, so it wouldn't be a chatzitza for that reason, Haina Rabise. Or it's the normal fashion of this person having their hair could be, either dangerous otherwise, or at least, this is Rabise, meaning this is the way that the person needs to live in order to have a manageable hair. So based on these considerations, I wrote a tshuva of being mekel, as long as the person soaked their hair in warm water for a long period of time before the tefillah, and Rav Schwartz and Rabbi Willig were maskim to that tshuva. And these are situations that just are reflective of realities of our time. The realities, could be in the realm of tefillah. They could be in the realm of milah. You have, all kinds of people who had a bris milah when they were little babies by an Orthodox moyel who didn't know that they needed a gear. They only discovered when they're 20 that their mother wasn't really Jewish. So was the milah good when it was only done l'shem yadus? So it's the question that the author of the Sefer Bris asked Shmuel Salant, who was makel on this, or Tzvi Pesach Frank was also makel on this, and the Minhag Olam is to be makel to say that the mila is really a hasaras hamonea. As long as there is a kavana, the shem yadus, for the purpose of Jewishness, people bring a raya from the sugi of milo tavla, the nidasa milo tavla, the kiria, the rashi over there, that as long as the person did something, the shem yadus, that also is considered to be good enough, certainly for bris mila, would be considered to be good enough, so we don't do an extra tapas on bris, as long as it was a valid bris that was done for those reasons. What if you have nowadays the surrogacy situations, a person who's had two mothers, one was Jewish, one was not, a genetic mother and a gestational mother. One was Jewish and one was not, so we're not sure who's the real mother, right? Halachically, it's a big machlokas, so we do a gir l'chumra. So what if the parents, are not so frum? What if the parents are not so frum? Normally, we only convert a gir katan based on zochin if we know that they're going to be raised in an observant environment. What if it's not such an observant environment? Can you be more mako, given that there's a 50% chance that, according to some poskim, the child is Jewish anyway, that they shouldn't have to live in limbo? So maybe you should do the conversion anyway. Rav Ezra Bick wrote a letter to Asya, to the medical halachic journal Asya, making that suggestion. I thought it was a good suggestion, but you have to have a consensus before you agree to relax a particular standard. Schechter was not so sure about this particular leniency, but you have to look at the totality of all of the circumstances and considerations, maybe to go a little bit easier in terms of how you're going to define Zochin with somebody who went through that type of a procedure, at least if the parents are affiliated with an Orthodox congregation. Bottom line is the Rambam tells us that you have to take the mitzvah of Ava Sagir very, very seriously. The question, at what point does Ava Sagir begin? Does it begin only after the Geirus, or when you know that you have a sincere candidate? I think, the Chidah famously says, we don't say Goish and Isgaya, we say Gersh and Isgaya, meaning every single Ger was destined on some level to be a ger. Like the Gemara we just learned in Daf Yomi and towards the end of Shabbos says that the mazel of every single ger was at Har Sinai. There was a certain destiny, a certain yud, that this person would eventually be a ger. When you see that somebody's a serious candidate, I think there is a certain amount of avas a ger that's already supposed to kick in. The Rimi Barcelona says that the mitzvah of gerus is really part of the mitzvah of Avas Hashem. It's part of the mitzvah of loving a Kodesh Baruch Hu, so you help people develop their relationship with a Kodesh Baruch Hu. A person enters into the ultimate relationship of becoming part of Klal Yisrael, the Am HaNivchar. So that's something which you should support. So the Rambam says that the Kodesh Baruch Hu was Tziva Al Avas Agir Kemosh Tziva Al Avas Atzmo. commanded us about Avodas Gevurah, like he commanded us about loving Hashem. Shneimar be'avdas Hashem Elokecha, that Hashem Hakadosh Baruch Hu Atzma Oev Gerim. Shneimar be'Oev Ger. Hakadosh Baruch Hu himself loves Gerim. So we have to, you know, be very sensitive in terms of making sure that we have the right systems in place in order to perform gear properly for those people who are a Geir Tzedek. Gemara Pesachim says, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put us in Chutz La'aretz. The reason we're not all in Eretz Yisrael yet is because we're supposed to do our job at identifying those people who should be going through a Geirus and joining Klal Yisrael, so we can have all the right people in place to welcome Mashiach Tzidkenu, Mehera B'Yabedu, Amen.
Any question?
Phil?
Ruby says, wondering if you have time for a question.
100%, please.
Approximately how many Gerim go through the process through the RCA per year?
So I think at this point, you know, discounting for the last several months in which nothing has been terribly normal, but what we've been seeing in general in terms of the GPS, you know, the GPS Batei Din, there are about 12 Batei Din that are part of this network under the auspices of the RCA. The Beit Din of America is, I think, around 250 a year. I think it's approximately 250 a year. It's been going up steadily every single year by a little bit, you know, as more people utilize these services. But I think that's the number.
And is there like a registry where like a Rav or someone who's like in Shiduchim can like check?
Well, again, you want to safeguard a person's privacy per se, so you don't necessarily divulge their records. But there is a central office which is managed very capably by Rabbi Michal Zoberman. And he has, you know, all of the records. So if there is somebody who went through a conversion who wants their conversion certificate to be shared with somebody or something of that sort, so, you know, then they can call up Rabbi Zilberman and authorize it. But there are very careful records that are maintained.
Thank you.
Sure. Yes.
Rabbi mentioned the issue of determining what zachin is for a ger katan. What would be the RCA's policy if there is a standard about an intermarried couple where the father's Jewish and the mother's not, and she's not going to convert, and so the boy's being raised, but he's being raised Jewish, you know, but the mother's not Jewish. So
Rav Yitzchak Yosef has a long essay about this in his Klalei Agir, which he says that there's no automatic, you know, black letter halakha that says that because one of the parents is not Jewish, that you can't convert somebody. It happens that the GPS standard is that we're not secure that the child is really going to grow up in a consistent atmosphere of Torah mitzvot. If one parent is Jewish and the other parent is not Jewish, then how are they going to have a home that's suffused with Torah mitzvot that's not going to build in all kinds of mikshalim? But let's say the couple is separated and the child is going to be 100% of the time with the Jewish parents who's keeping Torah mitzvah. So even 95% of the time with that parent. So then that could be a different story. You have the case where the mother wasn't Jewish, but she was keeping all the mitzvahs. She couldn't convert for technical reasons because the husband, the father was a Kohen. And no Bezdin was going to convert the woman to be with a man who was usher to her, right? Because he'd be a Kohen and she'd be a Gioris. So there was a tshuva in Maraya Bazak about that. And Gedaya Dov Schwartz was also asked about it. And Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg was asked about it. They said, look, the children are growing up in a home which is basically a Torah home. It's just that the mother can't be halachically Jewish because of a technical reason, but otherwise the children are going to yeshivas, they're keeping Shabbos and kashrus and everything else. So then there is room for leniency. So you have to really look at the circumstances of the case. As a general rule, if the child's going to spend a lot of time in an atmosphere which is not permeated with Torah mitzvos, that's going to create a huge hurdle. But it could be that when that child grows up, that the proof will be in the pudding, so to speak. So the child becomes a teenager, and the child is more on their own, and they demonstrate that they did remain strong and they did remain in the fold. So then, as a gadol, they can present themselves in front of the Beis Din and say, okay, now I'm coming in on my own right, and I really want to convert, and I'll make sure to put myself in a setting where I'll always be able to observe Torah mitzvah. So the Beis Din has certainly performed conversions in those types of situations.
Rabbi, does the GPS have non-Ashkenazi batei dinim, or is it mainly Ashkenazi?
The GPS is mainly Ashkenazi batei din. There are certain dayanim who are Sfardim, like here in the CRC. One of the main dayanim who serve on every single Beis Din that we perform is a Sfardi. Is a dayan who's a Sfardi, Herzl Yitzchak.
Has there been like a direction to try and include non-Ashkenazi communities throughout North America? Do they have like a similar centralized system or not really?
It's a good question. I think that we do deal with the Sfaradim, but whether it's been, you know, a population specifically targeted or to have a herkev of a Beis Din, which is all made up of Sfaradim, that's probably something that that we should consider. We're not so good at that in our world, you know, to focus, you know, on the
you can try.
Of the Sfaradi population. But I think that we just sort of integrate everybody. And we haven't really thought about having sort of separate resources, but it's a very good suggestion.
Thank you very much for taking the time. Sure. Thank you, Rabbi.
Sure. My pleasure. All right. Hatzlacha, Rabbi.